Okay, so I want to first start with any announcements. Does anybody have announcements? Well, I can tell everybody we had a number of us were at the NSTA meeting last week. Louise, you're on the phone. You ran a workshop there. You want to just sort of give a brief update on how it went?
Sure. We had a short course that was on climate science, and we had a lot of representatives from clean groups there. And I've forgotten exactly how many teachers, but I think we had some teachers coming and going. It was an all-day course, and I think we ended up with about 24 teachers total during the day. And it went really well. The evaluations were outstanding, and was happy with that. Would like to have had more teachers there. But we also did a polar symposium on Friday and had about 22, 23 teachers at that, and had a booth for the Office of Polar Programs in the exhibition hall, and had a lot of people through there and represented a lot of the polar science teams and their educational outreach with climate change. And so it went really well. A lot of work. I'm still tired.
Yes, I was there also. I was participated in Louise's workshop the first day, and then I did a separate clean presentation. Don Dugenhaus, I know, did an additional presentation about the energy use. And we also had a clean and related climate materials at the NESTA, the National Earth Science Teachers Association, Share-a-thon. So, and that went well. So anybody else was there that had... Let's sort of give an overview of what they saw. Okay, well, let's see what else. We are in the process of putting together a set of coordinated session proposals for AGU. Right now it looks like there'll be about seven proposals we'll put in. They may ultimately, some of them, get combined. And I have most conveners identify, but if you're interested in being a convener and it covers a wide range of topics, let me know and we can add you to the list, because I just sent the email out last night to the interested conveners to start getting the titles put together and the descriptions. Those proposals are due by the 20th of April. And then we have the NAAEE sessions. I just want to remind everybody that the session proposals are due, I think, the 25th of April, and those are for particular content sessions to present your work. For AGU, it's just to organizing the session as a whole, and the abstracts for particular content will come later. And if anybody's also interested in NSTA for next year, I think the deadline is a couple of weeks away also. So those are the deadlines that are coming up. Are there any other announcements? Okay, well, if not, then we'll move on to our presentation for today. We have Rochelle Hollander from the Partnership for Education on Climate Change Engineered Systems and Society Project. It's a CSEP Phase 1 project, and Rochelle directs the National Academy of Engineering Center for Engineering Ethics and Society, and joining her will be some of her project team members, including Clark Miller, who is Associate Director of the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes at Arizona State University, and Jason Delborn is an Assistant Professor of Liberal Arts and International Studies at Colorado School of Mines, and Junko Marr is an Associate Professor in Civil and Environmental Engineering at the Colorado School of Mines, and then we have David Rabkin, the Farion Director of Current Science and Technology at the Museum of Science in Boston, and David Sittenfeld, who manages the forum program at the Museum of Science in Boston, which engages citizens, policymakers, and scientists in conversations around emerging scientific and technological issues. And so I'm going to turn it over to Rochelle, who's going to talk about climate change, engineered systems, and society. And everybody should have the slides that were posted on the website. So go ahead, Rochelle.
Thank you, Tamara. That was a good introduction of us all, and I'm glad to have this opportunity to talk a bit about our Phase 1 project. As you'll see from the slide, our initial partners were the National Academy of Engineering, University of Virginia Charlottesville, Colorado School of Mines, Arizona State, and the Boston Museum of Science, and team members from the Colorado School of Mines and the Boston Museum of Science are here with us today, as is one of the program officers from the NAE Center. The focus of this project is, quite an important and somewhat unique as a thematic area in this set of partnership grants, although a lot of the partnership activities in one way or another will be including issues that involve engineered systems in society. Ours specifically looks at issues of climate and engineered systems in society, including issues of governance, sustainability, justice, and public trust and engagement. And the core recognition in the project is that society mediates issues of climate through engineered systems, so that mediation must include issues of public trust and engagement and governance, and questions of justice and sustainability will be decided in that mediation. So we had an overall project goal when we started in its most general form, and you can see that on the slide. But if you go to the next slide, you'll see that as the project has gone on, we've become much more focused. At first, our partners have expanded, and as the project went along, we engaged with a number of different organizations, both to improve the project diversity, to improve the project outreach, and to meet our goal of developing a national network that engaged U.S. educational institutions to be better able to provide the kinds of knowledge and skills that would allow our citizens, our leaders, our professionals better to understand, assess, and respond to increasing vulnerabilities in our engineered systems and vulnerabilities that increase with climate change. And our focus was also delineated better to focus on undergraduate, community college, and tribal college education, on communities and community leadership, and on informal education in science centers involving children and adults. Our activities have included the standard activities that are important in any kind of planning effort of activating the network, figuring out how you're going to manage it, having teleconferences as well as meetings in which management issues could be deliberated and a consensus reached about going forward and about how to focus the effort in its continuation. We did hold two network workshops, which did a good job in helping the network partners and expanding the network partners in their focus on technical and normative dimensions and on the educational dimensions of the issues. Of course, as part of the grant, we needed to develop inventories. We needed to review what kinds of relevant materials, educational materials, were there, what kinds we would need to be focusing on and implementing in the future, and identifying and developing test beds and approaches. So our continued priorities are the focus on case development and targeting effective learning materials for specific network audiences, continuing testbed experiments, identifying additional experts and local partners, completing our workshop and evaluation reports, doing our phase one, considering undertaking a phase one wrap-up workshop, expanding our networks both with professional organizations and online. And we have been posting our project information at the address that you can see on this slide for project priorities. Finally, in outcomes, we have indeed identified people to be members of our continuing external advisory board. I should mention also that the project has become part of the Climate Change Education Network, which is part of the NRC, so that in going forward, our activities will be also sponsored with that Climate Change Educational Roundtable. We have found that our conversations, our interviews, indicate that indeed we recognize the severity of infrastructure vulnerabilities and the multiple pedagogical needs that exist and the unmet need for multiple pedagogical approaches to assisting audiences understand and figure out what to do about these needs. We've identified our theoretical frameworks, both in terms of what STEM learning requires and what educational success requires. And you can see that on the final slide. We have identified cases that we can use to illustrate key issues and both the research that needs to be done on them and the research that needs to be done in order to have learning materials that are indeed useful for different and differentiated audiences, as the final note on the last slide tells you. So I tried to go through that pretty quickly because I want to have plenty of time for my team members to talk about some of their efforts over the course of our planning project, what they've learned, what they see as needs for the future, and where we might go and others who are engaged in partnership activities might go in the future. So let me ask first our the team members who are here from the Colorado School of Mines to comment, and then we'll turn to the Davids from the Boston Museum of Science. So it's Junko and Jason.
Yes.
Yep.
I can start, Junko, and if you like, and then you can jump in at any time. One of the things that the School of Mines team has done is we did some research with existing faculty here at the School of Mines who teach science and engineering courses to students who will be engineers one day. And we did some research about what are some of the barriers and opportunities of including an educational component about climate change and engineered systems in existing coursework. And some of what we found was that there's some resistance to including climate change because some faculty see it as a kind of as a political issue. And so some of the inclusion of the content on climate change within existing engineering courses falls under the name of sustainability, for example, seems to be more palatable to some of the engineering faculty than talking about climate change. That said, other faculty have said that climate change is just, you know, yet one more constraint that engineers need to think about in terms of designing for future conditions. And so for some faculty, they include climate change as a kind of taken-for-granted constraint on design, and they talk to their students about needing to include that in thinking about what they do in their future professional careers. So part of our focus at the School of Mines has been to coordinate some future workshops among faculty both from Colorado School of Mines as well as engineering faculty from the Denver Front Range to think about how to develop best practices for including more education on climate change and engineered systems within the engineering curriculum.
I'll note, too, that engineering faculty often feel somewhat constrained in terms of the content that they deliver because of, you know, ABET requirements and things like that. And so at one of the workshops, we actually heard from some ABET-type people and found that very helpful.
Can you define what that term is? You're referring, I think you're saying an acronym, but I'm not sure.
The Accreditation Board for Engineering and Technology, I think, is what the acronym stands for. Basically, it's a group that accredits engineering degree programs. And so every 6 years or so, we are visited. We're actually preparing for a visit this fall. We're visited by a panel, essentially, that evaluates our engineering programs and accredits them, says whether they are meeting the ABET standards, essentially.
Yes, so you can see that is quite an important aspect for engineering education. It's certainly the case that engineering programs want to be accredited, and when they are accredited, they want to keep that accreditation. The ABET has maybe the last dozen or so years, they have included a number of societal and ethical dimensions as part of what their expectations are in that are aspects that should be covered in accredited engineering programs. I believe that one of the things that this ABET member, who's a member of their committee that examines these criteria and also is one of the fellows that does such visits. One of the things they have under consideration right now is, I believe, the question of sustainability. Is that correct? Perhaps Junko and Jason can say something to this, but it was quite interesting to hear him talk about how ABET develops its criteria and standards, which are then posted for all of the engineering programs to look at and think about as they put together what they're going to show when they do have a visit from this group. One of the interesting things he said, I hadn't quite thought much about the distinction, but he said that ABET accredits programs, not colleges. So in the College of Engineering, I guess it's the various programs that are accredited rather than the college itself.
I'll just jump in.
I just have a quick question. When I understand that the accrediting group is looking for particular content for the engineering programs, is the inclusion of climate a plus, a minus, or a neutral in terms of that? Does it help, or is it just as long as everything else that they expect is included, you would get accredited?
So I'll comment on that in that the outcomes for programs that ABET defines are actually pretty broad. They do not define content per se. So, for example, their first program outcome is an ability to apply knowledge of mathematics, science, and engineering. They don't say, you know, in an electrical engineering program, we expect you to have, you know, this. They do within the electrical engineering specifics, but generally speaking, they don't. So the one where climate change, I think, would fall currently is broad education necessary to understand the impact of engineering solutions in a global economic, environmental, and societal context, as well as the knowledge of contemporary issues. And so, they generally are not looking at specifically whether certain topics are hit in a particular program, at least, in terms of broad societal issues.
And the word sustainability does appear in that same list of their student outcome criteria, where they say an ability to design a system component or process to meet desired needs within realistic constraints, and then they list possible constraints as economic, environmental, social, political, ethical, health and safety, manufacturability, and sustainability. So that's where sustainability currently appears in their guidelines.
This is Clark Miller from Arizona State. The challenge of ABET in terms of sort of plus, minus, or neutral is that one of the problems that engineering departments have and curricula in general have faced is that there's a lot of pressure from students, from faculty, and from industry to maintain the undergraduate degree in engineering as a professional degree. In other words, with that undergraduate degree, you can practice as an engineer. And that has meant that there's
a
series of things that incorporated in. And so the engineering curriculum has had a real squeeze on it in terms of being able to fit everything that people feel is necessary for practicing engineers to know into the 120 or 130 credits that an undergraduate engineer will take in a four-year curriculum. And as a result, engineering students have tended to see their average length of time in school grow, so that many of them are actually there now longer than 4 years, not because they're being slowed down by other things, but simply because there's so much stuff in the curriculum now. And any kind of extraneous information has been squeezed very hard and often out of the undergraduate engineering curriculum. And so I think what Junko and Jason are saying is that from the standpoint of ABET, you could probably think about this as climate change as neutral. In other words, it's not something they're specifically looking for, but there are places that it fits, and they're not specifically looking to exclude it. But from the general challenge of the squeeze on the undergraduate engineering curriculum, it is yet another thing that would have to be added in, and therefore, in many people's minds, something else from the existing curriculum would have to be lost in order to maintain the current limits on the size of the undergraduate curriculum. And this is an issue not just for climate change. This is an issue for all sorts of things that that have been proposed to be added to the undergraduate engineering curriculum.
Yes. I think the approach that this project has been taking is rather than, there kind of are often seen to be two major orientations towards these kinds of sort of special topical areas in science and engineering education. One orientation says, well, do a separate course. One of the things that is often the case now is that there will be separate courses, for instance, in engineering ethics. They will satisfy the kind of general education requirement for engineer engineering students while at the same time offering a topical area that is of considerable relevance rather than a more general approach to, say, questions of ethics in society. Another approach is sort of the inclusion approach, which says, okay, how do we, I'll use a somewhat negative word here, but don't mean it that way. How do we shoehorn this in? How do we make it part of a standard engineering curriculum such that the faculty who are teaching their courses have a way, a legitimate and a legitimate way to make these issues a useful part of the engineering curriculum, such that students there are various justifications that are given for one approach rather than the other. One justification for the inclusion approach is that it then is seen to be a central and useful dimension of engineering education per se, not what could be viewed as a sort of an add-on or an extraneous element. And I think I can say, and Jason and Junko and Clark, I think, would agree with me that the project itself has taken much more the inclusion approach in the various kinds of curricula that we're interested in, which are not just engineering curriculum, but to have this question of climate and society or climate engineered systems and society be integral to the courses and curricula.
Right, and I think there's also a sense that, you know, smaller interventions and multiple courses might be more sustainable over the long term than a standalone course.
Yes. Yes. And that probably there's probably reasonable grounds to believe that with respect to this area. So let me turn to David Rabkin and David Sittenfeld to talk some about the work that the Boston Museum of Science has been doing.
Hello, it's David Rabkin here. David Sittenfeld is with me, but we'll start with me anyway. In phase one of this project, which we've been discussing, the museum had kind of three principal areas of focus, one of which was looking at what's already been done in the museum world. A second was doing some testing on site here in Boston. And a third was kind of assembling a network of museums that would continue to be engaged in the project as it moved forward. So with regard to the first task, we did a survey of exhibits out there in the museum world, looking at about 70 exhibits. And we were interested in part with how was climate change being framed, and to what extent were engineered systems being used as part of the way the problem is framed, or as a key educational component or key set of messages within those exhibits.
Can I interrupt for a second? This is Tamara. When you say you looked at a set of exhibits, were they exhibits that were focused on engineering, or were they exhibits that might be addressing climate change?
They were general exhibits that were addressing climate change. And one of the questions we had was, to what extent do they actually really focus on engineered infrastructure of our society, the impact of climate on it, and stress the importance of that? And what we found was that actually only about 14% of the exhibits
really dealt with engineered systems. A lot of the focus was on sort of climate basics. Is the climate changing? Talking about impacts, mostly in terms of climactic impacts, rather than really putting much focus on how does it touch the systems of our society, although that kind of stuff clearly was addressed, but it wasn't the focus of the exhibits, and it wasn't really used as a tool to draw the visitor in. It was not a central part of the framing of any of these exhibits. And as I said, we looked at about 70 exhibits overall, so we had sort of a sense of how the museum world is kind of framing these in the context of exhibits, which is different from programs, and I'll get there in just a sec. One of the things that we felt, and I would say it's a bit of a Museum of Science biased perspective, but I think also integral to this project as a whole, was that we felt that the notion of the impacts of climate change landing on different people differently, and that different perspectives are needed in terms of thinking about designing solutions to problems, maybe weren't called out as much as we would stress in our own work. And that's more of a footnote. When we turn to doing programs in the museum, we imagine, for us, doing programs that involve a fair amount of dialogue between different perspectives or exploration of dialogues. That's one of our particular interests here at the museum. But when we prototyped, we weren't necessarily able to do all that we wanted to do, and we focused on some basic questions. One of the basic questions was, if we framed a discussion about climate change for our visitors in terms of how it touches the everyday infrastructure of our lives, would that make the topic relevant and understandable to our visitors? And we were fortunate in that in the state of Massachusetts, very recently, well, back in the fall, there was released a climate adaptation plan for the state. And in that climate plan, there were a number of case studies that they used. They looked at the Spalding Hospital, which is a hospital being built in Charlestown right on the waterfront. They looked at the Deer Island sewage treatment plant out by Logan Airport, which is a pretty low-lying water sewage treatment plant, and also looked at a number of public transit-related pieces of infrastructure and likely impacts on that. So we had these three concrete areas on which to focus, and we developed a presentation that we gave that tried to bring together the idea of a changing climate, its impacts on infrastructure, and the decision-making challenge that planners face in the face of uncertain levels of outcome associated with changing climate. And so the presentation kind of swirled around these cases and those three concepts. And we asked our visitors afterwards about their familiarity with the set of issues, and in particular with climate impact on infrastructure. We asked them about how important it was for the museum to cover these topics, rather than how interested are you in it. We asked the importance question because we wanted to get at something with a bit more gravitas, not sort of how personally interested are you, but given kind of whatever you think it is that a museum should be doing, is this an important topic for us to be addressing? And then finally, we did ask people about their own level of interest. What we found was that visitors felt relatively unfamiliar with the infrastructure-related issues, and they were probably most aware of sea level rise-related kinds of questions, but they really hadn't thought about it in the context of how you design a hospital or how that might actually affect the way cities like Boston or Cambridge think about their building codes, for instance, and the way they zone. And so generally, visitors did not feel that they had a good grasp of this set of issues. They felt it was very important for the museum to address these issues. And in fact, it was kind of rewarding because we got 74% of our respondents saying it is important or very important for the museum to be addressing these topics, which we felt was, you know, a little bit gratifying given the importance that we feel. And what we found was that more than 70% of our visitors said that they were so interested in this category of topic that they would attend another presentation on it, which is a darn good result in the kind of surveying that we do. What I don't have is solid evaluation that would answer a question of great interest, but I think we have a good gut sense that by grounding the conversation about climate change in very specific kinds of climate impacts, and very specifically how those climate impacts, like changes in rainfall patterns, affect the way we need to think about the design of a water treatment plant, for instance, it makes it understandable and very real to visitors. I think that as our experience suggests that as a teaching tool in the informal learning environment, this topic area can make it accessible and interesting to a pretty broad population of people. And generally speaking, I would say that although our surveys were only of the people that stayed to the end of the presentation, the presentation was held in a completely open theater in the middle of the museum, and people can come and go. We had very, very, very high retention of visitors at these presentations. Although we didn't track it, but just as speakers, we know a topic that holds people and a topic that doesn't. And this did, in fact, hold our audience. Let me finally say a few words about the museum network, and then I'll pass it back to Rochelle. So despite our interest in it, the question is, would other museums be interested in being part of this project? And the answer is yes. In fact, there are plenty of museums that are interested in doing it. And they're interested in it for a couple of reasons. One is that we have quite a few museums that we've worked with in recent years who have had positive experiences working with networks of other museums. So through the Communicating Climate Change project of Aztec and through the NISNET project focused on nanotechnology that the Museum of Science helped lead, we've got a lot of enthusiasm in the museum world about the power of a well-run network and the real synergy that's possible from museums that work together and share with each other. In addition, there is a movement in the museum world towards addressing really substantive societal problems, and to do it in a way that brings together policymakers and scientists and the public into a dialogue where conversation flows in all directions, and the visitor is regarded as a meaningful participant in thinking about policy. Because deep down, what we're trying to do is to inspire interest in decision-making on the part of our visitors, to give them knowledge that can help them in thinking about the decisions that they may make on a daily basis as consumers or as professionals if they're adults, or possibly as policymakers or as citizens voting or otherwise participating in a political process. So decision making is important, and there's a movement that people refer to as public engagement in science, which for us really means struggling with different perspectives and uncertainty and the complexity of real-world problems. And we've had a lot of success with it here in Boston, and other museums are interested in applying their own skill sets and taking these ideas in their own directions. So we've had a lot of interest, and we've got active participation for the future from Science Center in Ithaca, the Arizona Science Center in Phoenix, Oregon Museum of Science and Industry in Portland, Koshland in Washington, D.C., Museum of Discovery and Science in Fort Lauderdale, and Science Museum of Minnesota. And that group is interesting in a bunch of ways. Interesting because of its diversity. There's large and small science centers in there. There is geographic and cultural diversity there. There is involvement in different museum networks. There's a real range of programmatic skills and different inclinations in the way these different institutions tend to approach things, ranging from science theater to more media-based things to more conventional kinds of presentation programs. And when you look at that group and you think about the types of climate and infrastructure issues that might be relevant to their audiences, you realize we span a lot of territory. And so when we look at those museums as participants in our network, we think they bring a lot of opportunity to take sort of archetypical climate and engineered and social systems kinds of problems and to regionalize them into very specific local examples that touch their own audiences, but that tie into these larger kinds of system problems that the network is devoted to and the kind of thinking that we believe is important to addressing those problems. And so when we think about the kind of archetypical cases that our network wants to deal with and how we bring them kind of down to earth in each location, we see great opportunities to work with these different museums and for them to put their own spin on what the network produces and to add it into the mix of product offerings that we make available to the overall museum world. One final word about the museum world is that the Association of Science and Technology Centers is also a partner in this. And, of course, they have enormous ability to communicate with the science center world, to disseminate to it, and to bring professional development into that world and reach a really broad an array of science centers, not just the big ones, but a lot of little ones that it would be tougher for the museums and the network necessarily to get to in any kind of systematic way. I think I'm going to stop there and hand it back to Rochelle.
Well, thank you, David. I will pick up maybe on one aspect that relates to what David has just been talking about, and that is that one of the things that's come out of this planning period has been the identification of a number of cases that can be used to illustrate key issues and that have the potential to be regionalized or localized in ways that become relevant at numerous both informal education institutions but also formal education institutions. So is Clark still on the phone? I don't know if he is. But in any event...
I am, yes.
Oh, you are, good. So I think one of those, one of the cases that we're talking about developing 6 to 8 of these in the next phase of our activity, one of the cases would focus on urban heat islands. So, and Clark and our potential partner at Duke, I think, would be interested in this. Duke, I think, is also interested in ports and sea level rise. So that's an indication. And so let me ask you, Clark, if you would like to talk a bit about how we're approaching this case-oriented education and the delineation of educational approaches for different audiences.
Sure, I'd be happy to. The approach that we've developed is to start with a robust foundation of intellectual work in each of, at the moment, we're imagining 6 to 8 case areas that span, we've mentioned urban heat island and U.S. Ports to also include engineered river systems, so flood control navigation systems on U.S. rivers, also looking at some other areas. But the idea is that in each of these cases, what you have are complex interactions between climate processes. So what's going on with respect to temperature patterns, rainfall patterns, wind patterns, extreme event patterns in a particular context. And then you have engineered systems that interact with those. So if you think about an engineered river system, for example, if you think about out here in the West, we have a watershed which can cover literally hundreds of thousands of square miles of terrain that has water patterns falling on it in the wintertime as snowfall and snowpack, and in other periods of time as rainfall. And so you then have patterns of melting, and all of that is flowing into storage reservoirs in the upper reaches of the watershed, as well as reservoirs and dams lower down that are being managed as water provision reservoirs, some flood control, a fair bit of hydropower. So we call those multiple purpose river system development. If you think about the Midwest, if you think about the Mississippi or the Missouri or the well, Mississippi and Missouri in particular, you have a lot of levee systems along those rivers. So these are quite complex river systems that are trying to achieve a variety of valued outcomes in terms of human communities, and in many cases have literally tens of millions of people who depend on these rivers. And then the third layer is that you have social systems, complex social systems. So if you think about the distribution and dynamics of how people were living within the levees in the city of New Orleans, or if you think about the Mississippi River flooding that we've had recently, and part of the challenge being that there's been a fair bit of development of communities behind in the flood zones behind the levees since the levees were originally designed and built. So you have these complex human activities that are interacting as well. So we have this complex systems interaction that's going on between climate systems, engineered systems, and human systems. So you start with an effort to build a rich understanding of those interacting systems and how that works and the models that you need to understand those and represent those and so forth. And then the idea is that for our different audience groups, so for cities and communities and community leaders, for adult audiences in science museums, for undergraduate engineers, you would tailor educational programs using insights from the learning sciences, using our knowledge from our educational practitioners about how best to deliver education for these different groups. You would tailor each of these case studies, and then you would tailor them regionally potentially as well in terms of applying them to applying our basic understanding of what's going on in these complex systems interactions to the particular variants of what's happening on the Mississippi River or what's happening on the Colorado River in the Southwest or the Columbia River in the Northwest. And so the idea is that we will develop educational products and materials, a number of different sets of those materials for each of our case studies, and that those materials would then be tailored for different kinds of audiences and made available to broad networks of folks throughout the country.
Okay. So we're actually pretty excited about this and would like to kind of try to figure out ways to interact with numbers of the partnerships as they have evolved and as they go forward to see where we might be able to help and to see ways in which others can help us, this certainly being one example. I imagine that CleanNet will be represented at the upcoming CCEP and NASA and NOAA PI's meeting in mid-April.
Yes, a lot of us will be there. The Clean Pathway Project will be there. We have some other members of the network who will also be there who have funded projects. One of the issues that I've been trying to deal with, this is Tamara, is that right now the tri-agency meeting is only inviting people who have funded projects within their defined set of programs. And there are climate change relevant projects, even funded by NSF, I know for sure, that have not been included. And I'm working to try to get those more integrated. But yes, a lot of us will be represented there in a couple weeks.
Okay. Good. So it's likely that that these conversations will continue, and that we can maybe begin to develop some kind of smaller sets of mailing lists that where we can keep each other informed. Right now, as you well know, also we have we get numerous emails about various climate change activities on a constant basis. So trying to keep up with it is beyond possible. So I'm hoping that we can carve out some ways to interact in the future that could be as informative as, for instance, the small panel that we put together at the second workshop back in October for our project, where we talked to some of the electronic websites that are working on this in this area, and where we might find some ways to interact on a more regular and useful basis in the future. So that's
yes, and one of the things that you can think of is if you I understand your desire to have smaller circles that you could manage. But one thing that you can use the Climate Literacy Network, both the listserv and this telecon for, or if you want to get broader output input to your effort, if you have questions either with respect to identifying relevant partners or just general impact from a very large cross-section of people with expertise and interest in these issues, this venue can serve you in that way.
Okay, that's certainly something to keep in mind and to work with going forward.
So are there any questions from anybody for Rochelle or the rest of their team?
This is Martha from Earth Advertising. I'm so impressed by this. It's really great work. Thank you for sharing.
Well, thank you. It's nice to hear a friendly voice out there.
Other questions? If not, well, I want to thank Rochelle, Clark, Jason, Junko, David, and David for a very interesting presentation. Wish you luck in the competition. We've heard from a lot of these CSEP Phase 1s, and the hardness of it is that they all are very deserving of being funded, and it'll be interesting to see how all of them move forward, some funded and some in other funding avenues. So, but I wish you luck in this competition, and a lot of us will see you in a few weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye now.